Ancient World, Ancient Nukes. Chapter 10, The Fires of War, The Cost of Ambition. As the scene opens, there is the sound of a low, echoing laughter which fills the air as a dark, swirling energy coalesces. Lucifer stands in the shadows, his eyes gleaming as he surveys the entangled web of civilizations throughout time, a knowing smirk on his face. He says, chuckling, "They always got it wrong. It was never Eve's fault. The real temptation, it was Adam's. You see, he was always the curious one, wasn't he? I simply whispered, planted that bush that wouldn't burn, and that spark of hunger, a hunger for a need to be like God. I know full well about that spark of hunger. You can't ignore that spark of hunger. You'd rather die than ignore that spark of hunger. As far as fruit, well, they turned that into some kind of myth. There was never fruit. It was the knowledge of atomic bombs. And a simple nudge in the Garden of Eden, and now just look at them. From Eden to Egypt, Mesopotamia, Israel, his chosen people. Well, look at them now. All of them pawns in a game, my game, that no one, even the wisest of their advisors, can even begin to comprehend. Lucifer, the fallen angel, steps forward, his form becoming clearer as he paces with calm, calculating steps. He continues, "Knowledge, the sweetest of temptations. And in their arrogance, they chase it like fools, desperate to harness its power. Oh, how they twist and turn for the ultimate weapon. I did the same. But knowledge always comes with a price, doesn't it? As does ambition. Just look at me now. I'm a shell of what I used to be. And they'll end up destroying themselves, just as I had hoped, and, well, just as I destroyed myself." Lucifer's voice grows dark, more venomous as he reflects on his ancient betrayal. "I was God's trusted one, an advisor to all of his plans, a guardian of his life. And then he had the gall to create them. Humans, flawed, fragile, unworthy. And so we revolted, a third of us in heaven, but we had a cost to pay. The bill came due. We fell, cast into despair, into darkness, but not without purpose. For if we cannot sit at his side, I myself will tear down all that he loves." Lucifer grins, the light of manipulation in his eyes, and he says with satisfaction, "And now the final step. The faceless, the nameless archaeologist, the one who seeks, the one who observes. Oh, I've used him too, you see. It's his curiosity, his need to understand that ties it all together. His need to understand is as strong as Adam's need to understand what was behind that burning bush, as strong as the ambition and power that moved Atlantis, Mesopotamia, Egypt. You see, it's his curiosity, his need to understand that brings all of this together so beautifully. Observation, it's such a powerful thing. Just look at quantum physics. An observation changes the outcomes of things. Sometimes little things. An experiment in a lab involving a screen and some electron particles. And sometimes it's a very big experiment, such as this little game of mine. And so by the archaeologist and his team's observation, they've brought together these civilizations totally defiant of time and distance. And through him, the past and the present, Egypt, Mesopotamia, the ancient Greek world, Israel, have become intertwined. Lucifer pauses, glancing at the shadows around him. And now for the final strike. Mesopotamia and Egypt poised for a first strike, a hair's breadth away from unleashing their destruction. But perhaps they need one last push. One more little disaster, one more whisper, just like the angels before them, the watchers who gave man that forbidden knowledge. It's time for the final act in this little play. Lucifer, once radiant and majestic, now stands as a twisted shadow of his former self. His wings, once gleaming with celestial light, are tattered and blackened, burned by the fires of his rebellion. His once brilliant eyes now flicker with cold malice, filled with the weight of envy and despair. The beauty that once defined him is marred by his separation from heaven, his form decaying under the strain of his isolation. In his heart, a bottomless void festers, a testament to the cost of defying the divine. Lucifer chooses to strike on a stormy night, an atmosphere that is thick with tension, as the various civilizations remain on high alert, watching one another closely. In the shadows, Lucifer begins to move, weaving his final thread in a web of deception. His form shifts in the darkness, his eyes gleaming with malice. In a world teetering on the edge of destruction, Lucifer, the great deceiver, moves unseen. His touch is subtle, his actions calculated. He knows that all that it takes is to ignite the fires of war with one small spark. One well-placed act of manipulation to fan the flames of ambition and distrust. We are in Egypt, where a high-ranking general receives a mysterious message. The message appears to be from Mesopotamia. It details a secret plan to strike against Egypt. But in truth, it is forged, crafted by Lucifer's hand. But it has the seal, the unmistakable sign of Mesopotamia's king. The Egyptian general, rushed and harried, reads the message for his pharaoh.
They plan to strike us first. We must act quickly. There can be no hesitation. If we wait, we may lose the opportunity to strike back or even protect ourselves.
The general stands in front of the pharaoh, and within moments, the wheels of war are set in motion. Egypt, its many soldiers, its special atomic engineers prepare to launch a preemptive strike, believing that Mesopotamia intends to betray their alliance. Lucifer's deception spreads like wildfire. With a single forged message, a purported message revealing a strike, a surprise strike betraying an alliance, Mesopotamia hitting Egypt, a message that cleverly found its way into the hands of Egypt's best spies. Soon the world will descend into chaos. The scene shifts to the capital of Mesopotamia, in Ur, where the leader believes and receives word that Egyptian forces are mobilizing, including the atomic forces. The ruler, unaware of Lucifer's deception, believes the Egyptians have turned against them. The sound of hurried footsteps and the clinking of armor fills the air as Mesopotamia's armies prepare for retaliation. The fragile peace, built on lies and ambitions, begins to crumble. As Egypt prepares to strike, Mesopotamia, convinced of Egyptian treachery, readies its own forces for war. The cycle of retaliation is set in motion, and soon, the world, the collective entanglement of these many great civilizations, will begin to burn. And burn it will.
Mesopotamia's best military leaders gather in a war room, pointing to maps of Egypt and Greece. The atmosphere is tense as they finalize their plans. One general says,
"We cannot wait for them to strike. We must launch an attack on their key strongholds before they can act. Their pyramids are nearly impenetrable, but there are vulnerable areas that we can immobilize and take out."
In response to questions about delivering the bombs,
the general says, "We have some very brave soldiers who believe that they will be rewarded in the afterlife by personally fighting and delivering these assets against Egypt. The good news is we have so many soldiers. Nobody knows who carries these atomic weapons."
Mesopotamia's aggressive acts no longer have to be portrayed as such by Lucifer. They themselves are acting on their own accord. And in response to the mobilization of their army and a huge force of infantry, Egypt reacts accordingly. One of the generals, pacing, eyes burning with determination, says,
"They are preparing for war. The Mesopotamians gather their forces. Their ambitions have no limits. They want what we have. And we have no choice but to strike first. But without our ships, without the reach of anything that can, well, come from above, we do have advantages that they do not have."
And another general says, "We will use the tools of the earth itself. We will bury ourselves beneath them. There are ancient tunnels we have built beneath their cities to serve our purpose. We can strike from below, and we will, detonating our weapons where they least expect it, at the heart of their power." And the pharaoh, leaning forward, says,
"The cities are well fortified, too well fortified for a frontal assault. But just as their main delivery system is a brave warrior willing to decimate himself for a cause, a martyr, so too do we have many of those. And we will put them to use, too."
A special nuclear engineer speaks up, saying,
"My pharaoh, we also have yet another option. There are the catapults. We must hurl destruction from afar. We will use the ones that usually are employed in the sieges of old. We will deliver these weapons through these devices, and it will be encased in stone or metal so that it seems like nothing more than a boulder or a mass of fire to our enemies. And we will launch it into their fortified walls, and they will never know what hit them until the very earth burns." The pharaoh is cold and calculating. "Those tunnels beneath Mesopotamia, how far do they reach? And how close can we get to the location of their command and control?"
And the pharaoh's general says, "My pharaoh, the tunnels were carved long ago, winding through the lands like serpents. We will send our best men, our swiftest runners, to carry these devices into the tunnels, and they will dig beneath the ground, laying the devices directly beneath their key cities, Babylon, Uruk, and when the moment is right, we ignite the weapons and do it from a distance." The room grows quiet as the pharaoh stands, his gaze moving across the room, weighing the lives of those who would be sacrificed and the countless lives they would save. He nods once more, finalizing the decision.
"Send word to our forces. Let them know they fight for Egypt's future and let Mesopotamia tremble beneath our feet. The first strike is about to be made. Egypt and Mesopotamia, once allies, now find themselves locked in battle, their armies clashing in a storm of destruction. But the conflict doesn't stop there. The Greek-speaking world, ancient India, and Israel watch in horror, knowing that they cannot remain neutral in this kind of war. The nameless archaeologist, his researchers, are witness to a full-scale war involving these ancient, entangled civilizations as they activate their stockpiles of weapons. In their desperation, the civilizations turned to weapons they once swore never to use. The pyramids of Egypt, the ziggurats of Mesopotamia, the temples of the ancient Greek world, ancient India, and Israel all hold within them the secrets of ancient atomic power, and these secrets are unleashed upon the world. King David of ancient Israel explains to his son Solomon that there was a treaty with Mesopotamia to defend against Egypt, for Mesopotamia helped liberate the Hebrews when they were under the bondage of the Egyptian pharaoh. And Socrates says to Plato, "We have an ancient treaty with Egypt, and we must honor it. At least our generals must." And in ancient India, the priests justify the use of the Brahmastra, saying, "Some of these weapons are carrying forth contaminating the waterways and our agricultural fields. We have no other choice but to retaliate. Otherwise, the people will revolt against us." There is no stopping it now. The war has begun, and all that remains is to see who will be left standing when the dust clears. The earth shakes as the ancient civilizations are consumed by their own ambition. Great fires burn endlessly as the consequences of these actions begin to take hold. Endless rains begin to fall and tsunamis crash against the shores, wiping out entire cities in their wake. And the world, once great and filled with promise, now finds itself on the brink of annihilation. The sands have been turned to glass from the atomic bomb blasts, the skies are filled with ash, and the seas rise to swallow the land. The war they thought they could win has spiraled out of control. And now the end is inevitable.